G'day folks, talk to Liesl Tesh. New South Wales State Politician, MP, representing the Gosford area. Yarn about where life started, and where it led up to an accident. Then on to paraplegia, acquired disability, rehabilitation. Life didn't stop. School teacher, in that busy schedule of being a bloody school teacher, decides to fit in multiple Paralympics as a Paralympian, winning multiple medals. And then decides to get into politics. Jeez, the wheels didn't stop turning. And they're still going forward, representing the area and the state, and as a person with disability, doing great work. Solid yarn. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to help further support the channel, the podcast, check it out. There's two tiers. If you choose one of them, want to roll with the squad, that'd be greatly appreciated. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Righto, Liesl Tesh, we're recording, we're on. Thanks for jumping on the podcast and having a yarn. And I've been wanting to get you on for a while now. So just seeing a lot of the important work that you're doing on the coast as a politician, but just a lot of the, you know, great work that you've done beforehand too. So welcome.
Yeah, no, it's a great honour. It really is a great honour, Jake. And hats off to you and the work you're doing. I mean, getting the voices that need to be up there across all sorts of alternative pathways. We're in a really exciting time in the world with technology and also the way we communicate and how we get to people. So bring it on.
Awesome. Appreciate it. You know, politician, teacher, Paralympic superstar, all happening. So doing great work on the coast. So, but you always haven't been from the Central Coast, is that correct? You were from up north originally?
Brizzy born. So I was born in Brisbane and we moved to New Zealand when I was 3 months old, and we grew up off the grid completely in a caravan that Dad made. So 5 cats, 3 goats, a rabbit and a pig. and just roving. My sister and I would walk with the cats and the goats on the beach in our gumboots and, Mum, we found a really big seal. It's like, no, we stood on it. It's like, it's an elephant seal. You probably shouldn't be standing on an elephant seal, kids. But no, a really fun, like a lovely upbringing. And we moved back to Australia. My godparents were at Lake Macquarie when I was 7. So we didn't go to school in New Zealand. So we moved back and started fitting into the real world at Lake Macquarie when I was 7. And then it was Newcastle Uni, and I thought I was going to be a town planner, and I volunteered at actually Y on council over the summer, and I couldn't live with the ethics of what was going on to the environment. So I did teaching and landed a targeted graduate position in Western Sydney, which suited me for my training from Barcelona to Atlanta, and then moved to the Central Coast because it was halfway between Newcastle, where my family and friends were, and Sydney, where training was. And here I am and loving it. Absolutely love the coast.
It's awesome. So, and then just reeling it back, because, you know, I've read some of the just bits and pieces, like, you know, and I don't know how, you know, because what stuff that's written out there, you never know if it's 100% true or not, but just some of the alternative, you know, upbringings that you had with your parents growing up. And that's awesome that your old man made a caravan, like, from scratch, you know.
And I think, like, I mean, that's like, Dad was really resourceful, and Dad was a creative architect, and he really didn't like working in the capitalist world. He'd rather work for the greater goods and spent time, I suppose, designing and mud brick cottages for the nuns and ferro cement nautiluses to meditate in but it was a curved caravan made out of plywood, and it was we'd just take it to a new place, and sort of, we'd only stayed in the same sort of area, but we'd be by the river, we'd be by the beach, we'd be by the cliffs, and really alternative. Dad did a little bit of work on the railways, but we mainly lived like we lived off bush tucker. We ate roadkill. My mum's family and lived close by to my mum's family, so it was good. And my sister was born over there. We drank the goat's milk. We had food from mum's family's farm and harvested and fished. I mean, Dad, we ate shark. We collected crayfish. We collected a power. We ate periwinkles. You name it. We ate the walnuts out of the trees. It was just a banana. Passion fruit, like what an idyllic childhood, but we were damn poor. That was the reality as well.
But yeah, that's awesome, you know, just like how that would open up your world and just, you know, what, that's an awesome upbringing. Like just hearing that, you know, just because you don't, you know, compared to what is, well, what they deem as normal, you know, like regardless if you got money or not, but it's just learning how to be resourceful, which is awesome. So before you get to that stage at uni, so you've come back to the coast, is that when you were down and around the coast of Lake Macquarie, is that because you've got an acquired disability, correct?
Yeah, no, so that was like I went to school up in Lake Macquarie, Toronto High School, where you weren't even meant to get a HSC. And, mate, there's myself in Student Parliament, my best friend's a professor, my other best friend ran Triple J for 7 years, like, so it's the girls from the rough side of public education, like, we're still great mates. But, no, growing up, went to school at Toronto and then Newcastle University, and as an able-bodied kid, so love sport, absolutely was the kid who put my hand up to get in any single team to get out of class, and just loved, like, I think I'm still undiagnosed ADHD, I'm sure. I was riding home from a girlfriend's place 2 days after my last exam in second year on my mountain bike that I rode nearly every single day. I swerved over the wrong side of the road. My bike hit the gutter and I somersaulted, I think, over the handlebars, and I fell down onto a concrete driveway that was parallel to the road, probably landed on my bottom, and all the vertebrae in my back went like smashed up, and L1 sort of was the one that took the brunt of the fall. Found by an old lady in her driveway who was a nurse, whose daughter lived over the road who was a nurse. So she was, and so the nurse came and said to me, is there any tingling in your hands or feet? And I said, all through my legs. And straight away I was treated as a spinal cord injury, which I think was really, really lucky. Really lucky. Like I think in a lot of, like, it's something I preached to the kids that I was teaching, like if someone's got a suspected cut, don't move them. And I don't know your situation, but I do know conversations about people who were moved and who weren't moved. Like, and the ladies I worked in Sarajevo who got hit by shrapnel in their backs, who then got taken in blankets through the night, who then complete paraplegics. But I think I'm a very incomplete paraplegic, so my feet are really wonky. I move my legs. I wear ankle foot orthotics and walk not very well, but I walk. So,
I assume so. That you're incomplete.
Yeah, because I wasn't moved at the beginning, and it took, I don't know what your situation is, but for me, I was down there and they poked needles in my legs. Do you remember that part of your
I was 25, and the thing was, and it was tricky for me because I was in a pool, so they sort of had to get me, it was hard to keep me stable. Just being in that situation because when I jumped into the pool, because it was a force of the water that it was a weird angle, and my head creased back where the vertebrae pinched on the spinal cord, and then that just starved all the oxygen off to the nerves. But yeah, so I wasn't that much older than yourself when you had your accident too. So yeah,
and we all remember it like an all frameworks around it. Like I don't know about you, I actually none of that part of my injury is very clear, and apparently you'll either remember it blow by blow or you won't remember at all. But none of that for about probably 2 weeks, until I woke up off the painkillers when I was told that I was going to be in hospital for six months, in bed for 2 months, and I was never going to walk again. That was my sort of first memory off the pethidine and morphine to keep me still. Anything else.
And was it all up in Newcastle, or did they send you down to Royal Ride?
They took one look at the x-rays in Newcastle. There was no chopper available at the time, and there's also discussions that I probably could have been a bit better if I got into a hyperbaric chamber quicker.
But, yeah, right.
So there was 2-day wait for a chopper. In the end, some friends that I babysat for said, we'll pay for a chopper for her. So, yeah, but the chopper took me down. I arrived in Prince Henry. There was no beds at Royal North Shore. So I went to Prince Henry Hospital. It was open at the time. It was the second spinal unit in Sydney. And went in, had a 5-hour operation. So I don't know what your scars look like, but I've got probably a 6-inch zipper down the side of my back where they went in. They actually took the fragments of bone out of my spinal cord. So
mine's from the base of my skull all the way down to pretty much the top of my shoulders. But same thing. They took the fragments out, but then they had to take a bit out of my hip. And then they replace where they fix a vertebrae, and then I'm fused from C4 just over C6.
Well, so, and have you got rods in yours?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got all sorts of stuff going on there.
In the good old days, no, like, so I had to lie flat on my back in bed for 2 months, whereas, like, I think nowadays they put some rods in and get you up fairly quickly.
Fairly quickly, because it used to be, like, people with, like, quads, like, with – breaking anything between, you know, in your cervical, within your neck. So back in the day, that's when they used to hang the weights off and do traction. But like you said, not these days. It's put the pins in and, you know, to hold the old noggin up and throw the neck brace on, and then but I just remember that feeling when they took my neck brace off and just the weight of my head. I was like, I knew I had a fat head, but Jesus, this weighs a bit, eh? So.
Well, we were a different, because we had this spinal ward and we all just had to lie down. So Patrick, who was beside me, he broke his neck, but he actually didn't lose any movement. But we were all just lying there. I was only allowed to train with one weight at a time because you didn't want to put pressure on your spine. But then Patrick had the brace. So he had holes drilled in the side of his head and had this neck brace on to keep his brace in place. So you're lucky you had your injury later than the good old days.
I know, right? So, like, going through, like, all the rehabilitation process and, like, really active person that you know, not that you were that, you are. So, but going through that, like, what was your perception? Because, you know, going to uni, and are you thinking, you know, can I still get into teaching? What about sport? What about, like, what was your perception on life when you're going through that stage of rehabilitation? Interesting.
When I was flat on my back, like, first of all, the physio said, would you like to try wheelchair basketball? And I had a little foam ball with the Perspex backboard that I used to shoot baskets in bed with the ribbons from my flowers so I could pull it back in. And as I got stronger, I could fill that with lollies with a foam cup, and I could peg it around the whole ward lying down. And it was really weird when we sat up again to see what people look like, because you just don't know, because you're looking at the world through a mirror. But when I was, like, they said, do you want to try wheelchair basketball? And that was 1988. No one even knew what Paralympics was back then. And then two really buff humans.
That's true.
Two really buff wheelchair users, Lisa and Peter Mills, rolled in and just looked great. And like, we play wheelchair basketball, come and try it. And I'm like, mate, there's life. And I think back then as well, people in wheelchairs weren't out and about. So there wasn't a normality role model in my framework around. So even going back to uni was like, oh my God, like, people were like, this girl who was walking last year and is now a wheelchair user this year. And just I got keys to the back. Like, uni was unreal making adjustments. But even then.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. It wasn't such a normal thing to be going to uni in a wheelchair. And then even teaching was actually really good. Accessible schools are not that easy to come by back then. So I took leave without pay to go and play basketball in Europe. But there wasn't an accessible school that could that needed a geography and Japanese business studies teacher. So I was actually able to stay away. I kept applying for 5 years, but there wasn't a spot in accessible school. So, it's been an interesting journey about, like, just working out how to fit in the world with wheels underneath you, I suppose, is probably welcome to your world. But, making the world, because it really is, it's not us that's got the disability, it's the framework, it's the built environment that is the barrier in so many cases.
Yeah, spot on, and that's a great way of putting it. You know, it's the framework of them not having the certain accessibility facets and that, to it in general, you know, and then it's just trying to adapt over time and, you know, really taking on the user experience and what we deem should be accessible, you know. And what was it like going back into, because, you know, I know kids a lot, I went to Wong High, you know, and that got a bit full on when I was a youngster back in the day and whatnot. And I know how kids can carry on at school, like to an able-bodied teacher. But what was it like wheeling into a class and just the, you know, what, how the kids would react, and or if you'd have to explain certain things to them? What was that like?
I don't know. It's really funny. Like, it just is. It just was me. And the kids, like, I think kids are probably better at adults at taking on new and taking on change. And I just rocked up. I think probably being the Paralympian gave me a bit of credibility. Like, even in 1992, what was a Paralympics all about? That sort of, that awareness came, I think, more so with Sydney 2000. But the kids were unreal. And seriously, because I'd then transfer out of my wheelchair and I'd waddle around the classroom, and if I'd go out of the room, you'd come back in. Like, by the time I got into the classroom, three kids had tipped out of my wheelchair, little buggers. It was something that was parked up at times, and it was something that, yep, I was in a whole bunch of the times, and it was part of the thing. I remember one student, I think, passed out, but was it, I don't know what happened. It's like, Lisa, we need your wheelchair. So I parked up, and so they took my wheelchair, and Brent got this student and wheeled her into the sick bay. So
it's, oh really?
Yeah. And it was really interesting when my first Paralympics was in Barcelona, and they said, you get paid to represent Australia. And, like, I didn't know that when I signed up to become a teacher. So, like, I'm in Barcelona, first year out teaching. I'm putting my card in the wall. My full pay's coming out, which is unreal. But in reflection, though, the journey that those kids have been on with me as a Paralympic athlete, and the learning that they've gone through about inclusion and disability, I think the investment of paying me at the Paralympics on leave, like with leave, has been incredible. Like, I think they may remember a bit of geography or business studies, but they definitely remember the stuff and the framework about disability and my legs in the corner of the classroom. And then, like, the kids will say, miss, you need your legs. And someone will run and get my legs because my legs are off and I'm in my wheelchair. So, like, and that's just, and I was just normalizing what our world is like. And the kids just adapt, and I think they forget that this is part of me. I'm just me.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, it's not the chair, it's who you are. And what you represent. And that's so great, you know, the years that you would have put in teaching and just the kids, like, taking on that inclusivity and what that means. And that, and at the end of the day, that's just, it's normal. And just saying that a part of life, you know.
Even then as well, because I was sort of the advocate for people with physical disabilities, so I thought, then you realise you're also the advocate for everyone with disabilities. So I actually went and I've done half a master's, not the policy side, because I hate the policy, boring, who knows, but in special ed, because I also advocate. So then it was about me working across the schools that I worked in to include people with intellectual disabilities as well. So I just think when you've got this under your bottom, it's really easy to speak on behalf of all. Like, it's difficult and people expect you to be able to, but I've done some learning and you do end up advocating for everybody who's got a disability.
Oh, big time.
Visible, and also invisible. I think we're also quite lucky because it's the visible stuff.
That's right.
Mm.
Yeah, see, that's always a tricky one. Like you said, the invisible disabilities and people getting it, you know, because I work with, you know, where it's adults but kids, and, like, even if it's teachers or certain parents or people in general, just trying to understand whether it's, you know, intellectual, cognitive or ASD, autism on some sort of level there, and that's always the tricky one there, the invisible disabilities. But so, like, flat out all this teaching, and so you're flat out, so was it various schools, like going from, if it was from Sydney to the coast, or
it was actually really lovely because I did my prac at my old school, Toronto High School, which is a bit like Wyong High School, I suspect, a bit of.
Yeah, 100%.
And St Paul's up near my home. Yeah. And so I was able to stay at home. But then the teaching job, my first job was at Crestwood High, which is at Baulkham Hills, which was an older staff who were really supportive. And that was like, and we did this big fundraiser for the Paralympics. And even then, kids that I taught back then in 1992, every now and then with social media, will still catch up. It's really interesting. But then I had 5 years at Erskine Park, which is out like in the rough side of town, out near Mount Druitt, and had just an amazing time out there with the young staff. And I was a basketball coach, and I still got great relationships. Whenever I'm in Melbourne, I catch up with some of the kids I coached, and we're still on the blower every now and then. So, and then from there, it was to Berkeley Vale Community High School, which was a comprehensive high school at the time. And then when that changed to the seniors and juniors, I took leave and I played basketball in the men's league over in Europe for 5 years. So
in the men's league for 5 years.
who would have thunk it? Yeah.
You don't muck around. Jeez.
When I broke my back and I started out there, which was at like the stadium, and that was another interesting thing. When I broke my back, they said, you're going to become a pensioner. I'm like, what does that mean? It's like, we pay you to go to uni. I'm like, oh, whatever. Having to not clean old ladies' houses, my mum's friends' houses for money was a bonus. I also got a ticket. Like I had my pension card to go on the train, so I could go out to Mount Druitt every Wednesday night and train, which was just fantastic. And that sort of linked me in. So when I got offered that job in Western Sydney, it was just ideal because that was sort of the heartland of wheelchair basketball. But when I started, we didn't have a women's league. We played in the men's league because we didn't have a women's league. We had sort of had this low level national women's competition. Nationals were once a year you played with women against women, but the rest of the time we played with blokes. So we actually worked as women to set up the National Women's League in Australia, a bunch of us, which is still going strong. So after Sydney 2000, they said, one of the Italians at the massive party after we won the silver medal, one of the Italians said, Lisa, would you like to come play in Europe? I'm like, oh, but I'm a girl. And they said, but you're good enough. And I gave this guy my number, like we were wildly drunk. And and then 2 weeks later, like I'm living at Wamberal, and a phone call comes at 2 o'clock in the morning. Ciao, Bella. Do you want to come and play in Italy next week? I'm like, oh, I'm a high school teacher with a sensible car and a job and a mortgage and But then I did the thinking. I thought, you know what? And I wrote my basketball resume with freetranslation.com and I sent it to the team. The geography teacher looked at the cities in Spain that I wanted to go and live in and which one had a wheelchair basketball team. And I sent it to those teams.
Nice.
And four teams got back to me. And so I took leave without pay for 7 months because I thought it'd be once in a lifetime, one season, and loved it and loved Spain. We, ahora hablo un poquito español, and I talked to the women around that came to watch. We set up a Spanish women's team. And then the Italian said, do you want to come and play for this team in Sardinia, which is an island in the middle of the Mediterranean? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, stop it.
3 years there. I bought a Vespa.
3 years there.
3 years in Sardinia. And parlo un po' d'italiano adesso. And set up the Italian team. And then I had a year in Paris and I was living in Paris and the Department of Education sent me an email saying, Lisa, you've got a job at Woy Woy.
Nice.
So there you go. Nice.
all come full circle and then back to the coast. So so it was pretty busy schedule and it would have been, and how'd you go about fitting that in regards to like your teaching, but then you played overseas, but you know, you've participated in a fair few Paralympics. So how was it still like balancing out that schedule?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Like it was unreal. Like in Australia, we've got a limited season. So you play a limited number of games. The season in Europe is so much longer. So it made me, like it was better than any of the training that I could have done in Australia. And I still advocate, we're now having a discussion about the Aussie gliders and how we can improve. They came seventh at the Paralympics, how we can improve. And it's about game exposure. And so having those number of games against all these different teams is not about learning to play against person A and person B, because we play against them every fourth week. This is just random people and you've got to read the game on the run and you've got to, like playing on a court where you're speaking Italian to one of your teammates, you're speaking English to another and the other guy speaks Swedish and you're a girl and everyone else is a boy and they're macho and crazy. But, and then juggling that and timetabling that to be able to travel around the world and then meet back up. Like I remember from Italy, I was going to go and meet the Aussie team over in the US, but the SARS virus broke out. So the event was cancelled. So I'd finished, like I only earned a pittance, but I had a great time over there. So I'm washing dishes and I'm eating hardly anything and I'm fit as all get out. I'm riding a bicycle, I'm swimming, I'm at the beach every day, I'm drinking coffee, waiting for when the SARS virus, and then like what else was it? Something else happened. But then finally I met with the team, like, and it was just about juggling to be with the team for the competitions where I needed to be. The next Paralympics was in Athens. So I'd come home for probably 3 months. So I'd casual teach and train with the Aussie women for 3 months. And then I'd go back to the European season for 9 months. So it was just a privilege. Like one of my girlfriends said, what are you going to do about your super? It's like, who cares about my super? I'm living the dream.
I'll get to that later. That's all good.
Yeah, I haven't got as much as you, but golly gosh, you're probably going to do what I did when I was like in my 30s.
And what did it feel like comparing to, you know, from 92 compared to your last Paralympics, which is in Rio? So if you're talking about, is that correct, Rio?
Yeah.
So how, like, if you compared it, like, the atmosphere, the and just how they would organise the Paralympics compared to back then to now and the accessibility of it, how was all that?
That's a really good question, Jake. And I'm in this massive timeline head rush of changes that have occurred over the years. And I've been to seven Paralympics. So, and Barcelona, like, I fell in love with Spain, which is why I then went and lived there. Like, I fell in love with Spain and the fiesta and the siesta and the party, like the life that and the exuberance that is the Spanish people. But and Paralympics means parallel to the Olympic Games, but it wasn't really until Sydney 2000 that the audiences and the connection and the organisation structures, I'm so proud of what we did in Sydney, really made it parallel. So the Paralympics was an event that happened, and it was a great time for the athletes inside that the Paralympic village, but the audiences and the passion of the crowd just wasn't there. So we really, in 92, I think my joyful memories is meeting all the players from all around the world and nothing to do with the audiences because there weren't any. But then the next games was Atlanta, and Atlanta was atrocious. Like, realistically, it's like they bailed out. They left the beds, like, it was almost like the beds were unmade. The food was rubbish. Coca-Cola sponsored the Olympics and didn't sponsor the Paralympics. It was like
hospital. That's a joke. Food.
Yeah, it was really. Yeah. So Sydney 2000 was just an absolute cracker. And I think the conversation about we had the ticketing where it was $20 to get in the gate. So kids, and that's to me a shapeshifter, kids came and they, instead of saying what's wrong with that lady, they say what sport does that person play? And they were little kids who just, I think, shapeshifted. They didn't have adult attitudes about disabilities. They just saw this ability. And I think they are then now the employees, but the employers of the future. So I think Sydney 2000, and then like Rio, we had more people through the gates at one of the weekend days in Rio than they had in the Olympic Games. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. And even London, like London's social media took the Paralympics to a height that we've never seen before. So also I think, and as I said before, the kids that I used to teach are still there, and I didn't know they were still there, but because of social media and now the incredible exposure that comes with the games, the kids that I taught are on the journey with me from like 25 years ago and 2 years ago. Like, it was just an amazing, amazing time.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's what I've noticed too, like the whole elevation of social, not just social media, but the media coverage in general.
Yep.
So when it's, you know, on, you know, mainstream TV, when going back to London to, you know, when we're looking at Tokyo now, and it was really, and just being able to access it when you can as well, like having, you know, if it's a mainstream channels and having them on your PC or whatever, and you can just click in and you know, you can watch a live event or you can watch something that's already been played, which is great.
Yeah, I definitely didn't sleep that much during the Tokyo game because this is the first one I've been as an audience. Like, I've never been.
Oh,
I was going to go over and cheer and watch and do some work with the Japanese parliament about women and inclusion, but and maybe some commentating, but the world just was a little bit rubbish at the time. So, and the first day, I'm like, I was so sad. I'm like, I'm going to get really depressed. This is really bad. But, mate, then I just embraced cheering from home. Like, we were on Zooms with all the old gliders. I was on talking to my teammate, like my sailing teammate, Dan, about the games. Like, it was just the camaraderie of the Paralympic movement when you're no longer a Paralympian was first experience for me in Tokyo. It was just unreal.
2 seconds.
Yep.
No, I was just checking. I thought someone was here. No, they're not. It's good. Good, good. Too easy. Sorry. So, yes. So, Tokyo Paralympics. Yeah, so, yeah, well, that's interesting, you know, now that you've got to experience it as a part of the audience and just seeing it, you know, from the outside and, you know, getting the green and gold up and, you know, cheering on the crew, like massive Paralympics in Tokyo, which is good. I'm spewing because I know, like, oh, hey,
I was so excited. Like we had a Olympic flame lighting ceremony on the first night. Like it was so good.
Can you just explain to like not just the viewers but the listeners of what you're just holding up?
Sorry, yeah, no, the Paralympic torch from Sydney 2000. So like, and that, like the fact that we got the bid for 2032 before the games just is so exciting for me. So this is a long pointy blue, white and red thing, and we were able to, people put their hand up to carry the torch around Australia in the lead up to the Sydney 2000 games, and I had the privilege of lighting the torch, the cauldron, at the entrance. So this was handed to me flaming by a student of mine called Hannah Crowe, who was in year nine at the time, who was part of the Surf Life Saving Club and part of the SRC. But definitely for anyone who's interested in sport, the 2032, get involved in the torch relay. It's a magical community connecting experience, and you then, like this little flame got carried and was the lighter of the big torch, the big cauldron. So
awesome. I'm glad you pulled that out. So,
yeah, lashings of good memories.
Good memories. So you've got to Rio. You've pretty much just reeled up on your Paralympic career. And that's, you know, that's a lot of sport that you got under your belt, plus balancing out teaching and just everyday life. So then what drew you into state politics, like where did that all come from?
It's interesting, and I think like I need to also say, like having that teaching career and juggling the sports career and everyday life, and I think you and I don't have, like we can have a conversation about everyday life isn't easy for someone who carries a wheelchair under the bum and got orthotics and the disability stuff, like the whole lot and the time it takes to manage your equipment and everything else. So thanks for acknowledging that part of everyday life. But, so in my everyday life, because I wasn't driving to Sydney 3 days a week for training because I was now sailing because you can't train at night time, I had time on my hands. And in my journeys as a teacher of Aboriginal studies, I'd come across beautiful Deborah O'Neill at a couple of events, but I'd bundled these young Aboriginal girls into a function at a Rimba RSL where Deb was speaking to meet the aunties. And Deb said, Lisa, you should join the Labor Party. And you know what? Like, I'm like, yep, you know what? And so I did. It was just, it's given Australia the policies that have shaped this country and the public education I received, the public health. Like if you and I had our injury in any other country in the world, the cost to us would have, and our families would have been incredible. So I just think my upbringing, my family didn't have money to put me through uni. My family wouldn't have been able to afford private health if we couldn't have the public health system we've got. And I think the NDIS is amazing. And so, and athletes are so selfish. And I just thought, I'd like to give back to my community. And I never dreamed of being a member of parliament in a bazillion years.
Yeah.
And so on Monday nights, like every second night I'd go to yoga and every second night I'd go to the Labor Party meeting. But there were people with my values, and I've always been, like my friends are fairly political, but I've probably been the most political person among my bunch. And so Deb always said, you're going to step up and do leadership roles. And I'm like, no, I've got sport. So sailing, what happens with the Paralympics is that the sports that are increasing in numbers get hoofed in and the sports that are not increasing in numbers get hoofed out. So sailing was not in Tokyo. Badminton and taekwondo came in as our new sports, just like in the Olympics. What was it, rock climbing and skateboarding?
Yep. Skateboard.
So sailing was out because it's a really expensive sport. Dan and I had three
super
boats.
Super expensive, yeah.
Three boats. We had a boat in Europe. We had a boat in Rio. We had a boat in Australia. Like that, it's horribly elitist. And so
and the upkeep too.
Yeah. Like I used to whinge that a wheelchair basketball chair was worth like $2,000 in the good old days. They're now 10 grand, but like nothing compared to three boats. So, and understandably sailing was not in the next game. So I knew that part of my life was finished. What sort of winter sport can we do? What winter sport? But no. But so when Cathy Smith's letter, who was a member of parliament on for Gosford, came in the post to say she was resigning because she had cancer, I intuitively knew that my life was going to change. I didn't recycle the letter. I kept Cathy's letter. And it was a tough decision, like giving up your teaching career, 25 years as a teacher, and you've got a school
that's
that you
a solid
love.
Stint. Yeah,
you've got a school that you love, you've got kids and families that you've worked with for years, you've got a whole bunch of colleagues that are absolutely fantastically beautiful that you still catch up with whenever you possibly can, and to throw it all away, to put your hand up to possibly become a member of parliament when you don't even know what a member of parliament is, like
and that's it, it's a possibility if you get in or not.
And I'm really like, in state I can take leave. I took leave without pay to do the campaign. If I was running for federal, I would have had to leave, like quit my job to campaign. But it was a 2.5 month, very, very intense campaign for a by-election, and I came out victorious. And then it's like, oh my God, I mean, and then I get into the New South Wales Parliament. I said, Lisa, when you do your inaugural speech, which is the thing that supposedly sets the framework for who you are in the Parliament, you should have someone come, and because you'll get a special pin and you should get a professional cameraman. It's like, mate, I'm going to find out me getting gold medal in front of Sugarloaf Mountain in Rio. I don't need a pin in the Parliament. And so that was the journey. And it's an incredible job. It's almost to build your own adventure. You take your passions into that parliament and you stamp up and down for the things that you believe in and for your community, and you do your utmost to learn your community. You work out what's going on out there, where the gaps are and what they need. And it's like sport. Every 4 years for me, there's a you have to be at your peak because there's elections. Same as it's called a quadrennium in sport, it's quadrennium now in politics in my head. But it's about tactics and strategies and working out the way that you can use the parliament and the resources to deliver for your community. Yeah.
That's awesome. And like, because I've often like just sat back and just watched yourself, or you got Jordan Steele and you got other people with certain disabilities, whether they're in Australia, if it's state, federal, you know, other countries that are having a crack at politics, and just thinking, you know, once they enter the realm of politics, because you got, you know, self-conscious bias, and you got people that just have these ideas of people with disability and their life, and not just like with yourself with someone with disability, but also being a female as well. Like, what was, because when you're wheeled in there and just, you know, because you've got all these blokes, or, you know, or people in general in parliament, and just when it had to do with respect or how they treat you, and just that initial roll into parliament and how all that felt.
Yeah, well, I think that roll in for me started the day the Labor women came and door knocked with me on Bogan Road in Etalong. And it was like, oh my God, these are my people. These are my people. It was just like, I found my absolute sisterhood, and it was just unreal. And they're like, where's the curb and guttering? I'm like, I don't know. Let's go. And I actually think they were more disabled than me in their heels than I was in my wheelchair. So, yeah. But then I think in the parliament, and even like going into the parliament, the discriminatory line of this man looking down his nose at me saying, this is the oldest parliament in New South Wales as far as my demands for chasing accessibility in there. Like, that was, like, it's retrospective, but that was almost a stab in the heart. And in my head, it's like, there's a woman sitting in that chair. Like, we're women in here. This is a changing world. Like, we're going to make this parliament work for me and work for people with disabilities. And I can walk, but I'm still sitting on my butt in that parliament till I go back this time round, because until this time round, this parliament hasn't had a ramp out the back for me to get out of the parliament, to go to the tree of knowledge with my colleagues. So for 4 years in the New South Wales parliament, I come on the front, everyone else goes up the stairs, I go down the bowels of the parliament, I meet them up there, which is a pain in the neck for visitors, because my visitors, I've got to get them and meet them, and they go there. But the back is where we have our press conferences. So whenever there's, and also the protests and everything.
Is that where you come up? Because I know, like, going in there, like when you have to come up the ramp and whatnot, is that where you're talking about, where you first come up the lift and that area there doing the press stuff, yeah?
Yeah, that's one area. But then when you're a member, the general public are not allowed to go out the back way. But the people with disabilities in the parliament can't get out the back way. So there's a whole bunch of stairs. Every now and then, I used to just go down the stairs backwards, hang on to the rail, and go clunk down the stairs backwards.
Really?
And it took like, and then, so then on International Day of People with Disabilities, I'd make a video of how crap the access was in the parliament. And I did that for 2 years. And now we can build something because I've really highlighted and called out the government's inaction. And it's horrible. Like I got into the job and I had to choose between the parliament being accessible in my workplace or the Harbour Bridge because we had the Invictus Games. I know I'm going all over the place here. The
Invictus that's all good.
The Invictus Games were on 8 months after I got elected. And I know we've been campaigning for access to the Harbour Bridge since Louise Savage raced over there in 2000. We couldn't get up the bridge. So
I'll then put it's the bloody leafs in.
I know. So then here I am in the parliament. So we've got a shadow for Minister for Disability, Sophie Costa. I'm like, Sophie, we need to make the bridge accessible for the Invictus Games. This is embarrassing. This is like so embarrassing. I can't be in the parliament. I don't know. So here's Sophie.
Yeah, it is.
Sophie's knee high to a grasshopper. So we've got megaphones and we've got crowds of people with disabilities around us at the bottom of the steps on the north side of the Harbour Bridge at work time with TV cameras. What do we want? Access to the bridge. When do we want it now? So the bridge access came in time for the Invictus Games, which is really, really good. But the parliament's taken a bit longer. So that's actually been completed whilst lockdown's on. And I'll be heading in and I'm going to be doing some sort of wacky speech and standing up in the parliament to say, look, it's taken this long and that's still a disgrace because it's not fair that people don't have equal access to their workplace. I've been zooming around. I used to zoom around the back through the hospital and in the front gate again after we did an interview out the back. And then I'm like, to hell with this, because I know about workplace health and safety as well. In the end, I just to hell with it. I'm going down the car ramps in like, so then I'd get that we've got special constables at the back gates of the parliament. And I'd say, can you please stop the traffic? In the end, it was quite enjoyable. I think my last traffic stop was the Premier, at the time, as I wheeled down. And then as she got out of her car, I said, good morning, Premier.
Nice ride so, in front there.
Yeah, it takes a while. And as you know, it's like choosing the battles. And what we what do we aim for? I'm now working with some local doctors and a pavilion in Woi Woi, which is still, they've been pretending they're going to be getting access there for 10 years. This is going to become a bigger fight because they've been cajoling me and telling me, I don't know what truths, but now we've got two lovely doctors opened up there and their practice is not accessible. It's like, come on.
That's a joke. Doctors, not accessible?
Yeah.
Come on now.
But when you rent a place, like you assume that a modern pavilion with a whole bunch of shops is accessible, but it's actually not. So, So I think it's going to take a protest to people with disabilities at that step to get some action. And that's the length I'm prepared to go to now because I've been very polite about this for some time. Now it's time to, and you know, Jake, it's about your energy for your battles. And the other thing, they want me
you've
to
got to keep chipping away.
Yeah. But then the other thing is, do you want to become the shadow minister for disability? It's like, you know what, at this point in time, no, I want everybody to make sure that their portfolios are managed with the lens of disability and not disability, of ability in mind. So I'm sort of at the back reminding them about inclusion at all levels. So, yeah.
That's good. You know, like you're not, like you said, you're not the actual minister when it's got to do with disabilities, but yeah, you know, you're behind them and just trying to direct that lens, but just, you know, bringing it up to a level of inclusivity, whether it no matter around the state where it is, because that's a joke when you're hearing about an actual GP's office and you don't, that just cuts out so many people with disability that have got mobility issues, you know. So
and it is, and it's not just like you said, it's mobility, it's pram, like the ladies with prams all of a sudden understand our world, it's bicycles, it's just like it's so much now.
That's it. Older people with their walkers, So, and you're in the state politics and you've obviously had a focus and strong disability advocate. And what's been the focus like for yourself as a politician, but also the drive within your local area that you're a member of and that, and what you're striving for?
It's really interesting. Homelessness has been something that's been on my plate since the very beginning. So really being a bat for social and affordable housing, and that's now I'm just thinking about how do I manage this campaign and take the people on a journey, because realistically the Liberal government has sold 210 public houses since I've been in the job, houses with blocks of land, and they're replacing them with these boxy little, and I get we have to have affordable housing, but we now can see across the Central Coast and across New South Wales that housing, it's a housing crisis. And that's lack of leadership and lack of availability led by the government, plus the federal levers about what's happening with the cost of housing. It's frightening. So that one, yeah, that's a journey that I'm passionately on. Worked really closely at Presbyterian Aged Care, went up for sale. So we've now got a buyer in there that's supporting. There's 32 people living in affordable housing there that have been able to stay there. So making sure we hold on to what we've got, but also trying to push the government who live in framed boxes about other opportunities. Peninsula Village down on the peninsula are doing some work to refit some rooms so women escaping domestic violence have got a place to live, or older women who are vulnerable have got a place to live. Like Pacific Link, our community housing provider, are just doing amazing jobs across the coast, but we just don't have enough money, a stock of resources from the Liberal government in there. So that's sort of one passion. The environment, the double major geography teacher, is passionate about the environment. So this joke about PEP 11 and Lucy Weeks saying she didn't vote for it when their minister actually has to sign off for it for a stop. Like, it's all right for Scott Morrison and Lucy Weeks to say, we don't agree with it. But when their resources minister is actually letting it happen, we've got petroleum exploration happening off the coast that's been approved by the Liberal government. So
That scares me, that does, you know, because... Yeah. If anything, like, you've seen what's happened in the States when it's got to do with Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana, like, hey, you don't want that popping. You don't want that stuff in the water in general. Like, I know, like, they're looking at dollars and figures and cents and what it brings into certain occupations and sectors. But, man, it's not worth it to the bloody environment at the end of the day
absolutely. Plus, I mean, we're having this conversation while Glasgow is on at the moment, and we've got a climate buffoon. We shouldn't be thinking about gas exploration. We are a country rich in alternative renewables that we should be working on how we supply the Asian market, not by making a risk to our pristine beaches. We've got lots of other, we are an intellectual nation. By not investing in those other possibilities, it's a crime against this country. And that's the jobs of the future. Like, that's the real jobs of the future. Industry and commerce knows that the jobs are not in coal and in gas.
Yeah, you know, over time.
Okay, there's lots. Public education and tertiary, like, what's happened to our tertiary education sector federally? And it's interesting, I'm in state
politics. Super expensive too.
The conversations that we have between the different layers of government, the challenges that we've got going ahead with our council, and the stuff that's come out in the inquiry about our council that we're going to be, hopefully we'll get a very clear I think directive by the commissioner, and it's not just the Central Coast Council, that we need to have a really good look at the funding structures, the accounting processes and council management across New South Wales, because we've been the one that exploded, but there's a whole bunch of councils that are on very shaky ground, and the merging has not helped the situation in those councils as well, which is a big challenge to have on my shoulders because we don't have an elected body. So it's almost like I've sort of become a local government representative and a voice as well. So because I'm passionate, so people come for all sorts of things, and I learn so much, like just the conversation that I've just had about early childhood education and how they were frontline workers because they didn't even shut down like schools did. They weren't given the PPE. Their wages, even though they're teacher trained, don't match teachers. So there's a whole sector that's a women's sector, and even the whole stimulus post-COVID, so much of it's been about men and building stuff, whereas we've got so many women who lost their jobs who've been...
That's true. I'm glad you pointed that out, because the construction industry is huge and it's... predominantly men. Like, there are a lot of women that are coming up through the ranks, and because that's my background too in tier one construction, and seeing a lot of women coming up, which is good. But when you're looking at the balance and certain industries of what's going on at the moment, what you've pointed out, you're spot on. So it's trying to balance out the equilibrium there and just making sure that everybody's covered at the end of the day, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think definitely in this job, as I said, there's my sisterhood of these great women, and I've definitely become, like, I was a feminist before, but, it's looking at things through the pink lens, and I think a lot of the government decisions, if it was women at the table, some of those things would be considerably different.
Yeah, 100%, and I'm glad you bring up the social housing, because it's insane, like, what's going on the coast, but what I see in other places around the state too, like, when you're looking at the Northern Rivers, like, where you've got people that are like the amount of people that are homeless week to week, like up that way, like here on the coast too, because you got people that are moving out of Sydney and they're all coming up here, up on the coast, which is nuts. And it's just driving people out. And then when they're knocking down these old community social state-funded housing, and then they're, you know, throwing up these private, whatever it may be, if it's hotels or units, and like they're popping up left, right and center, as you would have seen over time on the coast. And it's like, okay, well, what now, where are these people going to live now? Yeah. We need to inject more money in a social and community housing, because it's huge. Because I see it from, you know, people that are able-bodied and that are homeless, but then it's like all these people that have got disabilities, and then they might not be able to attain certain jobs, whether if they've been, if they were born with a disability, acquired disability, disability is a whole. And it's like finding housing for all that mob now. Yeah, so it's like, and that's, you know, my passion's in that too. So
it's a huge, it's a huge leadership, and it's a really tough time. Like as our population changes shape on the coast, I mean, the little fibros down where I am in Woiwa are now $1 million. It's absolutely frightening. But about reshaping the housing market and apartment living as our population densifies, but nobody wants an apartment near their house. But then how do we then as government manage that moving forward and accommodate the planning and the investment to be able to function effectively? Yeah, like it's a big complex one, and there's interest rate questions in there as well.
And having a balance too with the council, it's like they almost need a body of, you know, if it's forensic administrators and auditors, so they can balance that right out, you know. And as you said, the coast is what's happened here, and then, you know, which is a shame, but then hopefully off the back of that, it's really going to rebuild the Coast Council and then put it full steam ahead, and then we can really inject and know, okay, well, this is baseline, this is where we have to be baseline, and this is how we have to move forward to for the council to thrive and survive. And so, you know, when it's got to do with your local council and then your state and federal politics, is this is how we can work on the different levels with each other, and this is how we can all talk to each other to get the social housing going, like, and trying to balance out that crisis to some degree, because I think there's not enough talk when it's got to do about the whole housing situation. Like I'm seeing bits and pieces, and there's people like yourself and a lot of other good people that are politicians and public and private figures, but it needs to be screamed on the rooftops 100%.
Yeah, so it really is. And that's like, I think in the lead up to the federal election, whenever that's going to be, we're going to be like, people are coming in my office. Like I've had police people in my office wanting to pay $800 a week that can't find a place on the coast. Like it's just, it's frightening, and it's not well planned. And there's some federal levers that need to be seriously shifted for the kids, our kids, to be able to live in our community. Like that's the thing. Like the kids that I taught, who haven't got into the housing market, what do we need to do to make sure that they can live in this community? It may not be in the quarter acre block with the Hills Hoist, but they still want to live in this beautiful community.
That's right. Mm. And, you know, the deposits they have to put down, and if they have to get, you know, now it's guarantors off mum and dad or nan and pop just to get a leg in, you know, because if you're looking at a 400 square block with a, you know, with the house on it that costs bloody 800k or whatever it may be, it's just nuts. So state, like if you're looking at the state politics, I'll get you just your outlook on, you know, where we are in New South Wales, what's your outlook and what your thoughts are on New South Wales state, and what your outlook is on federal. And then after that, I want to know what, if you had a magic wand, what would you do?
Oh, that's so well. No pressure. Holy macaroni. Yeah.
No pressure.
We've seen some very interesting changes with the Premier and ICAC. People feel sorry, I think, for Gladys because she's a woman and she's made some bad love decisions. But we've also got a very strict code of conduct that we sign moving into that job. Like, and if I breach that code of conduct, I should be challenged on that. And that's the rules. And we don't want people to break the rules, because rules are there to keep society safe and keep society fair, and also to keep society ethical. So, and I think now at both state and federal, we're seeing the shouting out of ethical behaviour and the pork barrelling that's going on. It's almost like we find a new pork barrelling every week, and you'd think they'd quit pork barrelling because they're getting in trouble for it. But Gladys said, oh, pork barrelling's okay, which is actually paying for stuff in Liberal-held seats. So at the moment it's air conditioning in schools. So the delivery of air conditioning in schools, like, is 23 schools in Liberal seats, one Labor and one Independent. Like, it's like...
Far out.
Makes me crazy. The other frightening thing that we've seen, we've now got a new Premier who was the Treasury for, who has sold under his leadership $93 billion worth of our assets. So $93
billion... Hold on. $93
billion. $93 billion.
Jeez.
I know, which is stuff that used to belong to the public, which is money-making stuff for the people of New South Wales, which is now being sold and then gets sold to private companies like toll, like public stuff that's now sold to a toll collector who now they collect tolls from the general public for 40 years and put it up at 4% every year, regardless of anything. Like, he's signing contracts. He's selling our stuff and he's signing contracts for the future that we'll be paying long into the future when we don't actually have money-making assets anymore because I've sold to private companies. And this is the Premier, when she was the Transport Minister, that started off the contracts for overseas countries to put their, like, to build stuff for us. So we've got the ferries built in China and Indonesia that don't fit under the bridge. We've got the trains.
That's nuts. Yeah.
That's nuts. We've got the trains that don't fit the tracks coming in. They're not in place. They're built in South Korea. We've got the trams that now they're built in Spain. We've got another lot, the inner city fast light rail is now got cracks through it, built overseas. So we've got this investment that the Liberal government's made that have been money going out of Australia to overseas companies and overseas workers. So we're de-skilling. Like, normally the government would invest in these things to maintain Newcastle as a shipbuilding industry or a train building industry.
That's it. Push up the local industries. We've got people that are more than capable to do this stuff.
Yeah. And so we're losing a generation of skills as well. And the profits go overseas. Like, it's just like there's on all the levels. We brought in some electric vehicle regulations in New South Wales a couple of weeks ago. But in New Zealand, that happened 15 years ago. Like, there's in my small country town where I grew up in New Zealand, there's 3 electric vehicle charging stations like 10 years ago. Whereas in Central Coast, we don't have electric vehicle charging stations because we don't have that government leadership and input. Like, it's just, I get frightened. And then even then, this government is giving subsidies to people who buy $78,000 cars. So on the Central Coast, that's not us. So this government's putting policies through, like, surely it's about time with the environment, but it just, like, it's like on all these levels, things are not happening the way that they should happen.
That's scary. And like what you're talking about with that $93 billion, like, that's a lot of, you know, land and buildings and all sorts of stuff that is gonna, and, you know, hopefully, you know, when you were talking about some of those industries that maybe some of them can come into the fold, like, and really start pumping that up, where it's, you know, instead of putting, you know, exporting a lot of that work, it's bringing it back home, because New South Wales, we're the most popular state in the country, and it's really making sure that, you know, because you can see, like, when you're looking at, and you would have said it too, Lisa, like, when you're looking at Sydney, and now it's starting to grow out and out and out further, out west, north and south, and, you know, we can't go east because we're hugging the coastline, but, and it's like, well, let's take advantage of, you know, some of the land that we got out there, and if it is bringing industry back home, and you can already see people thinking about it here and there, because obviously going through COVID, and it shows how vulnerable we are to certain sectors. That's for sure.
Supply chain gaps, which we're going to see, I think, also over Christmas. And it's ongoing. It was really one little interesting case study that we had was all the wheelie bins in Australia. Like, we've got a wheelie bin manufacturer up here on the coast that supplies basically the east coast of New South Wales. All the axles came from China. No one had axles in the world.
Oi.
Like, so that's just
people
like...
people are dragging their bins bottom out on the bloody road, no wheels.
Well, it just meant that bin productions had to slow down for... But, little things like that. But also this government also, and the pork barrelling that goes on is frightening even at policy level. So they put through legislation where they've got these renewable energy zones, and they had these 3 renewable energy zones in regional New South Wales, which were basically opportunities for them to try and buy votes to save the Nationals versus the Shooters and Fishers, because they're really not delivering to regional New South Wales. But it was Labor who actually added, and we're lucky at the moment in the lower house where I am, we don't have the numbers, but in the upper house, we've got the numbers to put amendments into legislation. So we've got amendments in there that means the Illawarra and the Hunter and Central Coast are also renewable energy zones, which is actually where the existing infrastructure is. Like if you're at Lake Macquarie, you see three stacks of power stations.
We've got the
wires, we've got the poles, we've got the wires, but we've got to change the shape of the electricity production. But to not include these heartland production locations with the workforce, the skilled workforce that we need to transfer change and retrain, this is a government initiative that we need to see on a scale with sensibility, not an attempt at pork barreling in the regional. And then the other thing is putting solar across really good farming land where we're this farming country and we're a great resource because we're so clean and green and we've got fantastic. Mm-hmm. But once we've got solar out there, we lose all this farming land. So the government's got to do better plan. They're just not doing the planning. We're not seeing that in the cities, but there's got to be much better planning of the future of our energy resources.
Yeah, and I think it's looking at the design too of some, this is just off the top of my head, like when I'm thinking of solar, like where instead of just fields of panels where you can actually build, and they do this overseas, where you can build towers, you know, so it's not taking, you're chewing up some of the airspace, but then you've got where you can keep a lot of that farming land, and where the solar, like then that can feed into and help that farming land. Like it just needs to be a really good thought out process and jumping into some of the knowledge that's working overseas, but trying to make what works within our different types of country around Australia, because we're so diverse going from, you know, when it's got to do with New South Wales compared to Central Australia, WA, far north, and then you've got some of the cold regions down south, but
it's like,
full on.
Yeah, and I'm biased, but I actually believe it's like a Medicare policy, it's like an NDIS policy, it's like carbon tax. It's got to be great leadership at a federal level, and I believe it's Labor that will deliver the leadership on the renewable energies that we need. Mm. That is a long-term, not ad hoc vote-winning stuff that's going on in our country at the moment.
So you've touched on some of the state stuff. So if you're looking at some of the federal, like I know these can almost be whole podcasts on their own, but if you want to
we do have to go eventually.
But if you want to touch on something there, and you know, if it's pulling out the magic wand and what we can do.
I think that the infrastructure investment is ongoing and really important. I think the fast train discussion, that's Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, who knows where that's going to end up, but I think linking some of those regions. But I think the most important thing of all is the climate change. Like seriously, we've got a leader who is a climate buffoon, and we've got a guy who's then, I don't know how they've managed to cajole that he's now leading on a global panel of leadership, but he doesn't believe in climate change. So it just makes Australia, I think, look like a laughing stock around the world about where we could be and where we are. And I think another frightening thing is the control of the Murdoch media and how that messaging is managed, so the average Australian who doesn't look or read or think too deeply into some of these issues gets led to believe that the Morrison government is actually doing the right thing by their children's future. That's probably my heartfelt passion that's going on there. I think that the job creation, and it's tough. Manufacturing in Australia and the cost of our workforce is really high, but we haven't seen a wage increase across this nation for a long period of time, and the cost of living, especially with the cost of housing now, has just gone through the roof. So we need to have a look about how we're managing the fiscal and monetary controls, and also managing the international businesses and how they're skimming money out of our system and not paying their fair share, because I'm sure if we actually get to the fair share of taxes by international businesses taken offshore, we can afford to live in a much different, like we shouldn't have homelessness in this country. We shouldn't have poverty. I got to Carryong where they've got a food relief and we've got people lining up desperately collecting food. Like we shouldn't have that in this beautiful, great country. We shouldn't have people who are so poor that they have to line up at the local community centre to get food to put on their tables. And that's not going to get better at the moment, at this point in time, with our cost of housing. And then we've got a government who promises at the election that we're going to have park and ride on the Central Coast. I just found out they're going to be charging people to leave their car when they stay longer than 18 hours in the Gosford car park. So it's fines, tolls.
Come on.
And fees, like it's just like what are you doing to the working people of this country? And hopefully the working people will wake up. There you go.
Hope so. Good. I'm glad you knocked that on the head. So and that's the thing. I hope that there is a raising of the bar when it's got to do with the way that some people do get paid across different industries, because the cost of living is just, it's nuts. It doesn't matter around where you are in the country, but I couldn't even imagine some of the people living in Sydney, you know, like with some of the rent and housing down there, and then it just works its way out to the coast. And as you'd see, so when you're looking at, so the National Disability Insurance Scheme, what do you think of it? And are you utilizing it yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely. I'm loving it. My orthotics, where are they? Yeah, my orthotics, my custom-made shoes are all part of that. And I've got a lady who comes to clean my house every 2 weeks, which is the best thing ever in the whole wide world, because you know what it's like? Pushing a vacuum cleaner in a wheelchair ain't the easiest task in the whole wide world. I just don't. And making the bed. Like, seriously, the core, like, just the little things in life that people don't think about that are the challenge, like a huge challenges and pains in the neck for us. So yeah, no, the NDIS, I think, sound labor policy that is really shape shifting lives for people with disability. There's still a lot more work to go. I think how we fit that in with early childhood education, how we fit that in with education, and how we fit that in with health. We haven't got there yet. The federal government that's taken a whole bunch of money that the Australian people actually committed to put into the NDIS, it's like $6 billion they've actually taken out of that to do with other things as well. So $6 billion more in the NDIS gives us a whole bunch more leeway to do so much more. So at the moment I'm working with Bill Shorten, who's the federal shadow minister for disability, and also our shadows across Australia, about looking at the shonky, like once government gets involved, there's so many shonky providers. So it's making sure that people with disabilities who are have got the money to pay for supports are actually delivered the supports that they're asking for. And that comes back again to advocating for people, primarily families with intellectual disabilities and people who don't have the care structures around them to be good advocates. And so disability advocacy is one of my absolute passions. So, yeah.
Big time, yeah. Yeah, because I'm an advocate first and foremost, but then what I see in the service provision world that I work in, and that's something that I really get gripes with. It's a lot of the people with the intellectual, cognitive, psychosocial disabilities that get taken advantage of, like where, like you said, they don't have a support structure that can guide them through of what they might be signing, and then they've just signed this whole big package away and they get taken advantage of. And then you see, like, if you go on the NDIS Quality and Safeguards Commission website, you can see all the providers that have been deregistered or fined, or they're not allowed to provide a service with, you know, for 1-2 years or whatever it may be. And it just drives me nuts, because, you know, myself as a person with disability, and just knowing that, you know, when the blood's in the water and it's dollars and stuff, there's plenty of sharks out there. Like, it's every industry, but it just drives me nuts, because I'm like, hey, you're dealing with vulnerable people here. Like, you know, so it's good that you've got, you know, it's people like yourself, and there's a lot of other good advocates out there, and it's getting money and dollars within advocacy and making sure that those voices can really be elevated and broadcast out there. And because NDIS is in fairly still new scheme, and it's great, but it's like you said, there's still things that need to be worked upon. And that's like when you're dealing with that magnitude of what it is and the money behind it. So, but we'll keep chipping away and doing the right thing. Yeah,
and I think, like, it's an amazing policy that's given changed lives for people with disabilities, but also given people with disabilities the opportunity to be out and about and in society as well. So I think that's a social shapeshifter as well, not just for us, but for the people around us and for the built environment, as there's more pressure to build and include.
That's it. Yeah. Okay, apart from your busy schedule, what do you do within your spare time?
Mate, I've got to go and I've got to meet a lady for coffee before too long, but I am a beekeeper. Actually, they're not here. I've just unpacked, like, I've had a bucket of honey that I've
You need your bloody suit on before you go grabbing bees, don't you?
Yeah. I got the whole suit, and I got the smoker and everything. I've got two hives. I've just given a third hive out. A bee swarmed, and we captured a third hive. And so I've just given that one away, because you're only allowed to have two hives. I love my bees. Okay. I love sewing. So I made this jacket on the weekend. Like, I don't get that much time, but the time with my ADHD. I'm pretty productive with the time.
Awesome, Jack. And two, by the way, I know I set it off there,
yeah,
but
look at that,
it is
look at
awesome.
That buttonhole. So I've got this really, so it's so lovely to be able to see a piece of fabric and visualise what it could be and then turn it into a posh jacket. So when you see me with the pink checker jacket out in the society, come and say hello. what else? I've just done, whilst everyone else was frustrated about not being going on holidays, I've actually gone on an internal holiday. So I've been meditating. I've been off the alcohol, off the caffeine. I've become a vegetarian. I'm meditating, and I feel fantastic for it.
That's
so that's
awesome.
About 2 months in. That's been my COVID project. So that's a whole bunch of self-discipline, which I think an athlete sort of has in the background there somewhere. But yes. I feel so good that going out, not having a one with the others is a bit challenging. But and who knows, I may regress or I'll choose how I party from here on in. But being a veggie has actually been really easy and really delicious. So, yeah.
That's cool.
A little nice thing. I walk the dog every day. I swim whenever I possibly can. I ride my bicycle. I fall off that every now and then because I'm not good at the starts and finishes. But, no, and just I'm so happy to be out and about. I just love people, Jake. Like, and
yes.
when you're in this job, being out and about and talking to community is so important because it's not just the event you're at. Someone's in your ear about what else needs to be fixed or who's in trouble or what I need to be having a look at. So I just love being out and about again. It's my job.
Yeah, it's awesome. And that's what I really like seeing across your social media. And that's what I wanted to say. If people want to get a hold of you, whether it's just have a general yarn or if it's got to do with political issues, whether it's got to do with the coast or whatever it may be, disability advocacy and everything in between. So if people want to get a hold of you, throw that out in the atmosphere.
Yeah, catch me if you can. No, I'm out and about. Like, if you see me and you've got stuff, come and talk to me. I'm a local member of parliament. I love to have a chat, and I'm really like, I'll leave you my card if I have to rush off. The social media stuff, Facebook's probably the best thing. I'm a bit crap at replying in the messenger of Instagram. Facebook's probably the best catch up, and a lot of the times we can answer people's questions on Facebook or direct them with phone numbers and stuff they need to follow up with. They put their concerns in Facebook, depending what it is, sometimes through Instant Messenger. I've got a phone 4342 4122 at the office. There's always two people, or work from home, there's always two people on those phones from 9 to 5. And my Gosford at email, Gosford at parliament .nsw.gov.au is primarily for my constituents, but we read all the emails and we'll follow up with stuff that I like is stuff that I can help with or direct people where it needs to go. Is that sort of?
Yeah, that's spot on. Yeah, so, right. Is there any shout outs, or we'll leave it at there, or what do you reckon?
Oh mate, shout out to you for doing what you're doing. Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a privilege. It's an honour. I absolutely love the Central Coast, and we've got the Tough Council program happening at the moment, but we love where we live and we will continue to rise up and make this place as good as we possibly can. I'm committed to that for the people of this community.
Spot on. Well, you're doing a solid job down there, down the southern end of the Central Coast, and I can't wait to see what you're going to be doing now that the world's opened up a little bit more post. We're still in COVID, but... and just see what happens with, you know, state politics and just politics as a whole, whether it's state, territory and federal. But, yeah, doing a great job, and I really appreciate your time. I know you're flat out, so really appreciate it. And, you know, I hope to touch base again on this platform time soon.
I look forward to it, Jake. You're a champion, and I look forward to catching up with you too.
Awesome. Just having a crack. Righto.
Thanks, awesome. Jake.
See, folks, the energy that she brings. Liesl, as a school teacher, getting that energy, pushing it out internationally as a Paralympian, and then smashing it in politics. Doing solid work. Like I said, keep it up. We'll just keep moving forward. Liesl, representing your area and the state, and people with disability. Love it. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. And if you want to help further support the podcast channel, and you click in and check it out, there's two tiers. If you choose one of them and want to roll with the squad, be great, be much appreciated. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah. or email one word streetrollingcheater@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.